Good morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of the House Fisheries Committee to order. President is Representative Feige, Representative Gaddis, Representative Johnson, Representative Christ Thompson, myself, Chair Seaton. Representative Heron will not be joining us today, and Representative Olson is excused. At this time, I want to remind everybody about their cell phones and to address their questions to the presenters through the chair. This morning, we are going to receive overviews from the University of Alaska Fisheries, Seafood, and Maritime Initiative. There's a approximately 75-page report to the legislature that everybody has received, and for the details, I believe we have PowerPoint we're going to be looking at mainly today, but want to make sure everybody had that full report to the legislature. And then after this overview and questions, we're going to talk with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game about short-term crew member license program. That's the 7-day licenses and how that interacts with our traditional programs. And we are having, continuing with some overviews. We will be starting to take up bills next week. So right now we will be looking at these overviews so that the committee, which is a new committee, our new members on the committee that haven't been here before, have a good understanding of the breadth of fisheries issues that we will be dealing with throughout the session. So if there are anything from committee members before we get started, seeing none, we appreciate the university being here, and we have Paula Collenberg, UAF Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program Director, and Vince O'Shea, Pacific Seafood Processors Association, Julie Decker, United Fishermen in Alaska, and Rick Caulfield, the UAS Provost, here, and I'll ask you each to identify yourself so we get the right person. We don't have name tags for you. So, and since we have more than one male and female voice, if there's questions, would you please just state your name? You don't have to say who you represent, but each time you respond for our recording secretary, it's very helpful if we get the right person saying responding. So without anything else, I just turn that over to you to identify yourselves and however you wish to proceed.
Okay. So we'll push this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Paula Collenberg. I'm the director of the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program, part of the University of Alaska. Appreciate your time to update you and talk to you about developing a fisheries and seafood maritime workforce development plan for the state, a collaborative plan between the industry, five state agencies, and the University of Alaska. And as Representative Seaton mentioned, these are the four people that are going to speak to you this morning and give you an overview. Myself, Vince O'Shea with the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, Julie Decker representing the United Fishermen of Alaska, and Rick Caulfield with UA Southeast. And Vince and Julie serve on an industry advisory committee to the university. So briefly, a year ago, the legislature passed HCR 18, which recognized the growing of the fleet in our state and encouraged the university to facilitate an effort to address that and look at different strategies that we could do to help ensure that our current workforce in fisheries, seafood, and maritime was strong, and also our next generation of young people entering these careers would also be strong. And that's what we've been working on over the last year. Specifically, the university has facilitated two large industry gatherings, one last spring and one this fall, scoping out this very complex workforce. So if you think of all of the jobs in the state that are involved in fisheries and seafood and maritime in every coastal community from farthest north to farthest south, you get a sense of the breadth of this this workforce and the complexity. And then if you think about what a significant percentage of the workforce is self-employed small businesses. That also makes it very difficult when you're trying to define strategies and work with state agencies. So we have been scoping that out, and then in the fall meeting, the industry really asked the university to establish an industry advisory committee to work closely on this effort. And in November, President Gamble appointed that committee, and I think you have in your packet something called, it's got colorful pictures on the top, it's called a January update. And on that update, there is a list of the current members of the industry advisory committee, and we have representatives from the fisheries, seafood, maritime sectors, and also five state agencies, including the Department of Fish and Game, the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, Department of Transportation, Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and Department of Education. And I just wanted to introduce some other folks here that are in the audience that are involved in this initiative, either on the Industry Advisory Committee or in support roles. And for example, Julian Curry, right behind me, Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. Candace Bressler with Department of Fish and Game, who's working on recruitment and retention in the department. And Dr. Milo Atkinson, who's a fisheries professor at University of Alaska Fairbanks, all engaged. So this is a really collaborative effort. It's industry-driven. We are looking at not just a training plan or an education plan for the university. We're looking at a statewide workforce development plan that will give strategies that state agencies and industry and university can all contribute to. And this is what's been done in our state already for the healthcare industry. It's been done for the oil and gas industry, and the mining industry is involved in this initiative as well. So that's where we're headed. Once we have this workforce development plan, then the university will be one of the groups, one of the partners that's responsible to respond to those strategies and say, okay, this is our role, this is our piece. But at this point, we are facilitating this effort. But it's not a university program, it is an industry-driven effort to develop a statewide collaborative workforce development plan. And so I'm going to, a couple of benefits, clearly, certainly benefits to having a skilled workforce in our economy, helps Alaska's economy, it helps the employers in our state, it helps the employees, it helps self-employed businesses be more successful. But we are focusing on career-level, highly skilled occupations in the fisheries, seafood, and maritime occupations that I think all of us, if we thought about it, we'd like to see more Alaskans in those jobs. So so with that, I'm going to pass it off to Vince and Julie.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Certainly. I'm Vince O'Shea, Vice President, Alaska, of the Pacific Seafoods Processors Association, PSPA. And thank you for allowing me to speak before you this morning. I'm here in Juneau representing PSPA, and I'm one of several representatives from the seafood industry that's participating in this initiative. Our nine member companies have hundreds of millions of dollars invested in Alaska. They operate plants across the state and collectively participate in nearly all commercial fisheries in Alaska. They buy and process more than 70% of the seafood that's landed in Alaska. I'd like to make three quick points to the committee this morning. It cannot be said too often how important the seafood industry is to Alaska. There are nearly 100 fish processing plants located throughout the state, and they're the economic backbone of the coastal communities where they're located. They provide markets to fishermen and jobs for Alaskans, and healthy food for the citizens of Alaska, the states, and the world. Earlier this month, the Department of Commerce announced Alaska exports set a new record of $4.1 billion. The largest product component of that was seafood. Our members want and need a high-quality workforce, enabling us to compete both nationally and globally. We have a graying workforce in Alaska, and we need to prepare for the next generation. good opportunities for advancement. The jobs that we're offering are available now. People in coastal communities do not need to move elsewhere to take them. We're committed to the Fisheries Seafood Maritime Initiative because it's a joint partnership involving the industry, the university, Alaska Vo-Tech, and the departments that Dr. Cullenberg identified. And to me, the key issue is this is a requirements-based program. We're going to find out what's really needed and where we get the best benefit of the limited training and educational resources that are available. This initiative is directed at upstream skilled level jobs. They tend to be year-round jobs, and they carry responsibility and earn higher wages. We think they should be filled by Alaskans, and that's why I'm working on this initiative to help make that happen. Be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman, at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Julie Decker, here for the Fish and Wildlife Alaska and Alaska Fisheries Development Foundation. I'm going to speak a little bit about what the fish harvesting sector and the maritime sector thinks of this development of a workforce development plan. I commercial fish and live with my family in Wrangell. I also serve on the Wrangell Economic Development Committee, and in that capacity, we've been looking at how to further grow our maritime support sector. So why is this important to fishing? I think one of the key reasons this is important is that there's been changes. There's been changes to the industry. It's different now than it was before. And an example of that is that the new generation getting into fishing has got to buy every single permit for every single fishery that they need to participate in. They also can't just fish one fishery. They've got to be diversified and work more year-round. So just there, that's one example of the fact that young people getting in, they need to have a huge amount of capital just to get into the fishery. They need to be able to put together a finance package. They need to be able to understand, you know, first of all, how do I get that from the bank? Second of all, how do I make sure through all the ups and downs I can maintain, you know, the financing side of my business? It's a little different than it was, you know, a generation ago. So those are the kinds of things that this workforce development plan, I believe, can address, can help us in the future. Another point for the maritime industry is we're seeing in coastal communities, the salmon industry has begun to rebound. It's excellent. There's more money. Fishermen are doing a lot of maintenance to their boats that they had previously postponed for years and years. They're building new boats. So a lot of this work can be and is being done in local coastal communities. There's a workforce springing up around all this work. This is an area where there is job growth today. And to continue that growth, we really need more training and higher level of skills. So this is another area where this workforce development plan is excellent. We'll be able to address that. Lastly, I think this workforce development plan is important because it's the first time it's ever been done in the state. And quite frankly, it's been done in other industries. Commercial fishing industry, along with processing and sport sector, is a huge part of our state, and it hasn't been done yet to date. So for that fact alone, I think the industry has rallied to support this happening and making sure that it works for us. So we know we need to be at the table saying, this is what we need, this is not what we need, this is how we think it should be, we should go about it. So that's all I have to say for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Rick Caulfield. I'm Provost at the University of Alaska Southeast here in Juneau, and I work with the Sitka and Ketchikan campuses. Worked with the university system for almost 30 years now. Started out in Bristol Bay many years ago in Dillingham. So I'm pleased to be here and have this opportunity to add my voice to, I think, a very important industry-led process that we hope will produce good opportunities for Alaskans to take positions in the fishery, seafood, and maritime industries. I just want to underscore a couple things you've already heard. First of all, this is really an industry-led process, and so I really appreciate the representatives from industry who took the time to come today to speak to you, because it's their input and the input from a number of others who are represented in the audience as well, the Department of Fish and Game, for example, and others who can identify where the opportunities are for young people, what credentials are required, and how the university and other education and training providers in the state can ensure that we're filling the gaps and producing graduates that will be able to take those positions. And I say this, I've in my university context participated in a number of similar sector-by-sector workforce development plan efforts. There's reference to the process industry. I participated when I was a community campus director in Fairbanks in the development of a workforce development plan for the process industry on the North Slope. And we were successful working with industry to identify the requirements that they have for process technicians who earn very good money with a two-year college degree, starting out at a very good income on the North Slope, and that was very successful. Similarly, we worked on a sector analysis with the healthcare industry, working with hospitals all over the state, and as a result, over about a 10-year period, we doubled the number of Alaskans in the nursing profession. So you can see where a plan like this, starting out again with close working relationship with industry, can lead to very meaningful results for Alaskans, and that's really our goal with this effort as well. And I'll also note that this process is very much on target with President Gamble's strategic direction initiative. The President's been here in the last day or two talking about the university's budget, and one of the core themes that he has identified is productive partnerships with Alaska's public and private industries. So this is absolutely right on the mark with the President's goal and the Region's goal for the university as a whole. So where are we with this process just now? You've heard about the industry advisory group that has been meeting. We've had a lot of very constructive feedback. We're now at a point where we're pulling together occupational data from all three sectors, fisheries, seafood, and maritime. We're asking employers and self-employed fishermen about the positions that are hard to fill and the skill sets and the certifications that are required for them to be successful in earning these positions. And we'll be sharing that information with the public for review and fine-tuning as we go along. But our goal is, by November of this year, is to have this workforce plan in place to make sure it addresses the industry needs, and then to be able to develop priorities in the university system and elsewhere to fill the gaps, as I said before, and to be able to produce graduates who are able to get those positions successfully. So that is, in a nutshell, where we are with the process. In the more immediate term, I just wanted to highlight, if we could have the final slide here, a request that is before the legislature as we speak. It's been approved by the Board of Regents and the President, and that is an FY14 operating and capital request, and it's found in your, I think you're familiar with the so-called Red Book, candy cane colored this year from the university, and there are five items altogether that this industry-led group has identified. The first is the Alaska Young Fishermen's Summit. Funding for that is a very successful effort. We talked about the graying of the fleet, and this is an opportunity for young people to learn about the complexities of the fishery and how to become successful in that arena. The second is focusing on fisheries technology. University of Alaska Southeast offers a 1- and 2-year program in fish tech that's available throughout the state. And we're partnering with community campuses in Prince William Sound, in Kodiak, and in Vista Bay in offering that, as well as here in Southeast Alaska. The third is the Alaska Seafood Processors Leadership Institute, again, where young people are interested in taking up a career in the processing industry can learn about the global markets that we're very much tied to, and that also has been a very successful pilot program, but we're looking to sustain that over the long haul. And then the final is in marine technologies, and this is something where we're looking to use the best of online and distance technologies to develop courses in areas like boat hydraulics, boat electrical, refrigeration that can be delivered at a distance, especially, you know, throughout the state to coastal communities, again, collaborating with community campuses in those communities, and then also identifying really knowledgeable experts in each of those areas that can work in an intensive course with people in those communities who are interested in those subjects. So it's using some of the new instructional technologies that we have access to today. And then the final one is actually in the capital budget. It's coming from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and that's a research component focusing on Chinook salmon research. And Dr. Milo Atkinson is here and certainly able to speak to that if that's of interest to the committee. It's a $3.1 million request. So with that, it's a summary of the FY14 budget requests that are in front of you today. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop, and I think we're all happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and we get to questions. You know, this isn't the budget subcommittee, process or finance committee, but these are initiatives that are directly impacting. So we will go into those somewhat, and they're open for questions, but I don't want to make this strictly focusing on budgetary components. But I am going to start with one question on that budgetary component, in that we have, the legislature has provided, with some sets this year, an expansion of the corporate tax credit system, which gives 50% of the first $100,000, gives 100% of the second $100,000, and then 50% of the next amount up to $5 million. And so I am wondering if the industry can address whether they have gone to their industry members and looked at the funding mechanism coming from industry for this amount, because it seems to fit into the kind of parameters that are there. That expansion of that, you know, sunsets this year unless it's extended, but it seems like this initiative is something that would be one of those things that industry has identified that is where they want to see money put. So the question is, do they want to put their money to this, or is this budget request in addition to calculating an amount coming from industry specifically for this initiative? I'll throw that to anybody who wants to start, because I think it's a multifaceted piece for several.
Mr. Chairman, Rick Caulfield, I'll just say that from the university's standpoint, the provision that you're talking about is a very, very important way of cementing partnerships with industry. And we have some good examples already where industry has taken advantage of those opportunities. And one of them, I would say, in the industry is Icicle Seafoods. They've been strong supporters of the programs that we offer. I mentioned the fisheries technology program that's available in coastal communities throughout the state. And Icicle has, Chris Norris, some of you know, and she's been a strong supporter. She and her company have been a strong supporter of these types of programs. Another in a different arena is in the mining industry, and we've had terrific support from Hackley Greens Creek, a little off topic here, but they have made investments, if you will, in university mining-related programs and taken advantage of those tax credits. So we think as a program, it's a very, very important opportunity, and I hope that it will continue.
Yes, Paula Kuhlenberg, I'd like to just acknowledge also that the School of Fisheries has a strong partnership with the at-sea processors through the Pollock Conservation Research Consortium that we've had for a long time, too. So yes, that's something that we look to and we welcome, and is an important part of being able to build up that partnership with the industry and do the work that they think is needed to be done.
Vince O'Shea, you know, I checked on the credits that our industry has been doing. It's been running about $650,000, which is a combination of both the education tax credits as well as contributions to the Wynne Brindle Scholarship Fund that the processors had set up. So we our intention is to continue to support that program. We believe in it. Thank you.
And I guess I just want to follow up, and I don't mean to monopolize the questions here, but I think this is an important one because I think what we've identified is an industry-led program, an industry initiative, and, you know, the state has provided a mechanism for the state putting skin in the game as well as industry to fund that. And so this is a year in which we are looking at constrained budgets, I believe. You know, we'll never know until the process gets through, but I strongly suggest that industry look to take advantage of the mechanisms that the legislature has put in place for partnering with the legislature through the revenue tax credits there for these programs, because I think it's an excellent program, but I just want to make sure that we are looking at skin in the game from everybody. So, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm curious, of your total new workforce every year, and I don't know if you have the numbers at your fingertips, generally what percentage of that workforce comes up through these programs or has to be trained for these jobs? You know, when I was coming up through the workforce in various capacities, and a lot of the jobs I took were, you know, basically bottom-of-the-barrel jobs. I had to get, in some cases, I had to get very basic qualifications, and then, you know, you just put your foot in the door and away you go. And I know, I've known fishermen. I've had you know, first officers that flew with me that, you know, they owned fishing boats, and they started hauling the net out of the sea. What is that kind of for, sort of informal apprenticeship program, or is that still? Is that still working in the industry, or is that still just a part of the culture? Or are we looking more towards formal training before people go into the industry?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Feige.
Go ahead and identify yourself.
Vince O'Shea. Maybe one way to look at it, it's a good question. One way to look at it is a number that's pushed around from our industry is 22,000 workers, but I think you know, a rough estimate would be 20% of those would be the higher end ones that we're looking at, and while we try to draw fill those higher end positions from, you know, initially the people that show up in our plants, the reality is a lot of the folks that come into those plants aren't necessarily back every single year, nor do they have a goal to make a career within those plants. So I think one of the reasons I'm at this table and I'm on this committee is because of our concern that these high-end jobs that we're going outside of Alaska to recruit people to fill them, because we're not able to fill them both from the workforce that shows up at the plant or from others in Alaska. And I'm talking about jobs like, you know, the high-end refrigeration guys, the mechanical engineers running the complex equipment within these plants, the food safety folks. There's a whole range of things. As soon as you were telling me about your experience at the entry level, I was thinking of two CEOs that are, one that's running one of our member companies and one that just retired from High School Seafood. One guy started out shoveling ice and the other guy started on the processing line. So there are occasions where people do go up, but I think there's a variety of reasons why not as many Alaskans do that. And I think what I see in this initiative is more targeted, that Alaskans get the training and then Alaskans fill the jobs, which is a win for us, it's a win for the community, and it's a win for Alaska. I hope that answers your question.
Fair enough. Thanks. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the $396 million in the governor's operating budget?
Representative, I think that's $396,000.
Oh, $396,000, okay.
So,
big numbers. You're right. Thank you. We deal with such big numbers. Is it in the budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, it is in the university's budget. It is not in the governor's version of the what he passed for the university's budget.
And
Representative Johnson,
and is the 3.1 million, is that in the capital budget, governor's capital budget?
And Representative Johnson, I think that we're going to get another person up to answer how that corresponds or integrates with the $10 million
that's my next question.
Yeah, okay. And so we'll have that specific question in a moment. Thank you. Julie, Ms. Decker, I should say, the situation you're describing with fishermen now being, you know, everybody has to buy a permit or multiple permits to be able to diversify enough to be in. It sounds like what we're talking about is different than when I entered the fisheries. I went fishing. I did exactly what Representative Feige was talking about. I started on the deck and pulling that, you know, all those kind of things. But now there's a huge capital cost because we have limited entry permits. So is actually what we're talking about training business people? Because it seems like with the capital costs, not only a boat, which you can learn to maintain, but the capital costs of acquiring permits and boats and all that, it sounds like we are more into development of small businessmen who happen to be in fisheries, or business people, sorry, didn't mean to mean men versus women, because we have a lot of very active fishing women. And it sounds like that's where this training, your vision is that correct?
One component of it, I believe so, yes. I mean, it's very similar, like you said, to small entrepreneurs, small businessmen. And there's a crossover there as well in the maritime industry, or the marine support industry. I mean, very much so you'll have, especially in the smaller communities, you know, just mom-and-pop owned, whether it's a welding business or fiberglass business or such, and these people are their own employer. I mean, they don't have any employees, and they're it's the same kind of thing. They need different skills than just the welding skills. They need also the business skills. But I think, you know, this is part of our challenge, is to create this workforce development plan in a way that addresses these three different areas and the crossover in a way that's effective. I think there's always going to be that traditional work your way up. That'll always be there, especially for people that are interested. In fact, I started out at the Ketchikan AGP plant on the processing line 19 years ago. But that'll always be there. But to move up or to secure the year-round better jobs, there's different kinds of training, and there's different challenges. And so this is a really good time, I think, to be looking at workforce development.
Paula
Kronberg. I think when we talk about workforce development strategies, we should think broadly so that it might include professional development for people that are currently working and want to move up the ladder. It could include informal education, you know, welding classes, hydraulics classes where you don't need a degree or you're not necessarily trying to amass credits. It could be a credit-producing traditional education. It could be strategies of partnering with high schools. You know, how do we get high school students engaged, and how do we tell the young people in our state about all of these different careers, and then tell them how to get there? You know, do the kids in Anchorage and in the Napster Valley, do they know that they could become a seafood engineer, or they could become run a large ship and off the ocean? And do they know how to find a way to get that? I think we have a lot of room to look at a whole wide variety of strategies, not just straight degree-seeking kinds of things. And we're dealing with a really non-traditional workforce in fisheries, seafood, maritime. So I think it's up to us to come up with strategies that adapt to that non-traditional workforce that we're dealing with and serve them.
Go ahead and identify yourself.
Vince O'Shea. Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one other thing and just make it clear. Earlier on, I think it was said that this has never been done before. And to clarify, it's never been done for the seafood
fisheries, maritime industry. But I think one of the advantages I see here, what we're doing, it has been done, as Eric said, successfully with the oil and gas industry, the nursing industry. So why I'm so enthusiastic about this is we're following the strategy and the model that's already been put in place, learning from the lessons of others, and these are programs that are producing results. So I think by being late, we have a jump on what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. One other Representative Christ Thompson.
I was curious regarding the fish tech component of this initiative. What fish tech programs exist within Alaska and perhaps the West Coast at large besides the UAS fish tech program? And what import a fish tech program plays to enhancement and hatchery systems across the state of Alaska?
Mr. Chair, Rick Caulfield, first of all, I'll speak to the UAS program, which, by the way, is housed here at the University of Alaska Southeast. Administratively, it's been in the Ketchikan campus. It'll continue to be available there, but it, in fact, we're shifting the administrative home to the Sitka campus because of opportunities to expand partnerships there, for example, with the Sitka Sound Science Center, which has an operating hatchery, part of the old Sheldon Jackson hatchery in the Sage building there. So that program has had success in Southeast Alaska, providing people who are skilled at working at the technician level with hatcheries, for example, in the mariculture industry. But really what we're interested in doing is expanding that as well to other parts of the state. So I mentioned earlier that we have a cooperative agreement now with Prince William Sound Community College to offer that program, offering it in Cordova, in Kachemak Bay campus, actually now with Carol Schwartz and her staff in Kodiak and out in Bristol Bay. So there's interest throughout coastal Alaska in a program that offers entry-level technician training, a 1- and 2-year program. A number of those people are already in the industry, but they're looking to advance their skill set and be more competitive, more informed, so they can be better employees. And one of the things we're trying to do is tailor it to the particular region. So even though there's a core of information that students learn through their online delivery, we can tailor classes to fisheries of Prince William Sound or fisheries of Bristol Bay, that type of thing, so that we can also draw on knowledgeable experts from those fisheries and from those areas to help teach the classes. So even though it originates from the University of Alaska Southeast, it's a partnership that will be tailored to the different regions of the state.
One other thing that I wanted to ask was, you know, I used to represent Seward Avtech, don't anymore, but it was a vital piece of the puzzle for Alaska. But with the changing regulations, has that, I mean, I know it's added a significant burden where you need certification in radar, you need certification in firefighting, you need certification in being able to conduct drills, safety drills on board of boats. You now have to be trained and certified, and you have to conduct those every month. So everybody has to, you know, there are a number of regulation changes, just like in other industries, that have come down that have dramatically impacted fishermen. I mean, if you go into a fishing boat, you know, whole walls are plastered with required stickers, required manning station plans, required garbage disposal plans, and logs, and all of those things. So I guess on those aspects, I know where Avtech comes in, but with the supercomputer or the simulator that we have there, has the industry also worked with them on certification, like through the Marine Highway System for pilots and those kind of things, or is that beyond where we're talking about in maritime?
Mr. Chairman, I can't really speak for Avtech other than my own personal experience, and I know that they do have a strong relationship with the Marine Highway System and training for that. And we do have Department of Labor and Workforce Development actively involved in our industry committee and working on this workforce development plan. And at this point, labor's been really helping us with statistics and occupational, characterizing the occupational codes that we have in our state, and making sure that we get a handle on the workforce with the information that they can provide. So we're not really at the point of delivery, developing new programs and looking at how they're delivered, but certainly at that point, I think all of the regional training centers will be involved in looking at this plan and responding to it. It's certainly not the university's desire to do everything for everyone in the strategies that we come up with. We don't have the resources or the time or the expertise, and those regional training centers have many of those things. So AvTech has come to our two large industry meetings and are represented by the Department of Labor on our industry committee, and we expect that we'll be looking at all of that as we go forward.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We did have a question from Representative Johnson that I'd like to deal with now, and that was that final item on the sheet where it's a $3.1 million capital budget request for the Chinook salmon research request. And did everybody get the... There's a passout of the tables from the gap analysis, and so if you do, go ahead, and then we'll bring forward
expert. Mr. Chairman, again, to the last point that you talked about AvTech, my assumption on working on this group is where it makes sense to do the training, that's where we need to do it. Where it's efficient, where it's effective, and that's the whole range of training resources within Alaska. That's what my interest is in participating on this committee. And I think that's the way we get the best bang for the buck with the limited amount of training and educational resources. So that would be my answer to your question, sir. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you all very much, and I think we'll get you, Milo, I don't remember the last name. We'll let you introduce yourself on the record, and thank you all very much for coming and informing us on this topic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name's Milo Atkinson. I'm a professor of fisheries at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Okay, and just to reiterate, with Representative Johnson's question was on this $3.1 million budget request, and we also wanted to know whether that's in the governor's budget or how it relates to the gap analysis. And although we will in the future get this gap analysis in detail and look at that as far as Chinook salmon across the state and what our research knowledge gaps are to answer the questions for better management. I would like you to, and we provided you those copies of those four tables, but what we would like to do is figure out how that budget request integrates with the $10 million that the governor put in to the budget for Chinook salmon research.
Yeah, and a lot of these decisions are taken above my pay grade, but the gap analysis budget request was meant to be an integrated budget request. It incorporated research from the university and research from NOAA's Fisheries Service, for one thing. We'd come up with a research plan for about $3.1 million. In this gap analysis, we're in the first of what I guess is planned to be three $10 million requests were allocated $700,000 under the label of process studies with the idea that the rest of the funding would be forthcoming out of the future appropriations. I think people higher up in the university were completely satisfied with that, and that's why you see a separate request in the university's budget.
So for clarity then, like on table one where we're talking about, those are harvest amounts, but on, some of these things about what we have for tagging studies or what we need for tagging studies or market recapture,
Table 3 is, you know, trawler offshore or genetic marker development. The 3.1 isn't tied to any particular of these research gaps. That's what I'm trying to find out, is where this request dovetails into any of those.
Yeah, Representative Seaton. So the university research is a little misleadingly labeled as process studies on the Yukon River. We're actually, the Yukon River part is the misleading part, but that's where the university-based studies are listed. The NOAA studies are the top two lines in that.
We're talking about Table 3?
Table 3, yeah.
Okay.
So we would be the fourth line down, the process studies.
Okay, and that was 700,000 about of 3.1?
No, that's 700,000 of the 10 million request coming from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Okay, and we do have somebody from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game that could come forward and maybe help make this coordination. Just, and again, this is not a finance subcommittee, but we are, you know, going to see a proposal potentially for research, and so that's where we're wanting to figure out where these are. Would you identify yourself, Kevin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. Just had this handed to me before, but certainly know a little bit about the topic overall. The governor's Chinook initiative is contemplated to be a five-year plan, $30 million endeavor. $10 million in the current request, in the department's current request, and we have on the out years on that request, it shows $10 million in both 15 and FY15 and 16 as well. Out of that $30 million, it is anticipated that the $3.1 million for the university would be included in the overall initiative. Now, how we would split that out over the years, we've asked for $10 million. It's not like that $10 million would be spent in the first year, but we will, and the other folks at the university are part of our research team, so their projects, my understanding, I can't speak for the university, but I can just tell you from my perspective, we would be doing RSAs with the university. It's contemplated to be $3.1 million in total. How that's divvied up on an annual basis over a 3 or 5 year period, it could be $600 a year for 5 years or $700 for 4 years, but the commitment out of the overall initiative is that $3.1 million. And then I think it has been generally categorized as process studies, and I don't really know who came up with the term, but I do believe that our scientists and university scientists are working collaboratively to come up with projects, and we have certain expertise. The university brings certain expertise to the table, and the feds do as well, and I think the federal government, we're hoping we're going to come through on some near-shore trial surveys and bring federal money to that equation that's not part of the governor's or the executive branch initiative request.
Okay, and thank you. And I think that what we're wanting to do is find out where this fits into the mix. And it sounds like the 3.1 is defined over time and is being included in the governor's request, and then would be RF. Proposed out whatever request for proposal or however you do that, and you anticipate the university participating for about that amount.
I think that's correct, Mr. Chairman. The other thing I would point out is I think the university was again, I'm trying to be careful because I don't speak for the university. I think they were putting their budget requests together this fall, as was the department, and we're all putting that information together to the Office of Management and Budget as they prepare the governor's budget. And
and that's fine. We're just trying to get an overall, again, we're not the finance subcommittee or the finance committee on this, but we're trying to get an understanding of whether we have separate research project proposals or whether these are amalgamated together. And I think that does anybody else have any question on that? I think that we understand now that we're not talking about two different universes of two different organizations going for research in Chinook on that. So I appreciate that, and I don't would you identify yourself again?
Minor Adkison, I just wanted to reiterate that all of the process studies that we're planning to do, we're planning on working quite closely with a bunch of fish and game staff and personnel and new personnel as well. We depend quite heavily on the data collection efforts of the Department of Fish and Game to accomplish our research.
Sure. Okay. Reverend Johnson, did that? Do you have any further questions on that? I definitely don't want to be speaking for you.
I was just, you know, it was a long answer to a fairly simple question. Is it 3.1 in the 10? In the 10? 100%.
Mr. Chairman, the 3.1 is not in the 10. The 3.1 is in the overall 30. And so it's proportionate, I guess is how it is.
Right, not specific, but it is coming through Fish and Game, and so we appreciate that. Any other questions, anybody? Thank you very much for the presentation. It sure lets us know a little bit more about workforce development and the structure going forward. I think duplicating the efforts and the directions of the oil and gas process technology, mining and healthcare is a really good diversity, and as we know, fisheries is another large sector of our economy, and workforce development is important for all. So thank you very much. We're going to take just a short at ease for a couple minutes while we go to our next topic, which will be with Fish and Game, and that will be short-term crew member license program, and we'll take just a couple minute at ease. Okay, we'll bring the House Fisheries Committee back to order. And we are looking at the subject of short-term crew member license program. This came up last year a little bit. We didn't have much data. We have now got data, and we have Mr. Brooks here to explain it to us. So would you go ahead and identify yourself on the record again and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you today about the 7-day crew member licenses. So this is a program that's been in effect since 2005, and it was created, I think, to provide an opportunity for an individual who might want to come up and work a single commercial fishery as a deckhand for 7 days or less. It was kind of referred to as a dude license. And since that time, we've seen it grow. It was pretty stable for the first 5 years. 250 to 330 licenses were sold, these 7-day licenses. In the last 2 years, that's jumped up. And actually, I want to restate that I was referring to the multiple ones, because we do have some other numbers of total 7-day licenses, because really I think the focus is on how many people are buying multiple 7-day licenses, because at the price point of $30, you can buy 6 of these if you're a non-resident at $180, and it's still less than an annual $200 license. And I think that really gets to the point that we're trying to get at. Was the pricing, did the pricing of this license in 2005 create a market response that was unanticipated? And so what we've seen is that we have had people who buy multiple licenses grow from 27 the first year. That was just a partial year, but in the first full year, 2006, we had 248, and over 5 years it remained pretty flat. You can see that depicted on the chart there. Included 330 in 2010, and then in 2011 and 12 we've seen it over 500. So we have over 500 multiple 7-day licenses being sold. And we know individuals, some people are buying as many as 6 of these. From the data, the table above, taking 2012 as an example, we had 17 individuals that bought 6. And we had 33 individuals that bought 5 and so forth. So we're able to calculate a loss in revenue, if those folks would have bought an annual license. And the numbers, really not insignificant. It's $61,000, based on our calculation for 2012. And over the life of the licenses, it's been $285,000. I would say, Mr. Chairman, it's on our watch list. You know, none of us really anticipated or knew how many of these would sell. Now we see that we have this dynamic taking place. But I'd also note that the non-resident crew member licenses, the annual licenses, are continuing to grow over year to year. And so we've grown, just in the last 4 years that I have in front of me, our non-resident crew licenses, we've sold for annual 8,000, 8,900, 8,900, and just under 10,000. So we've seen that annual number continue to grow while we've seen these 7-day numbers grow. So I don't know that you could necessarily say, would these folks have bought an annual one if they couldn't buy one or several 7-day licenses? You have to speculate and make some assumptions to do that. But overall, you can deduce that clearly we're selling more annual, and we're selling, in the last 2 years, we've seen these multiples grow, and so we're going to continue to watch it. The dollars are not, I mean, like I say, it's not an insignificant number when you get into tens of thousands of dollars. We work with our colleagues in the Department of Labor, because a share of this money goes into the Fisherman's Fund, which is, basically a workers' comp fund for deckhands. And interestingly, at lower levels of this, when someone buys up to 3 licenses, there's a loss to the Fisherman's Fund, but actually when you're buying 5 or 6, there's actually a gain to the Fisherman's Fund, because the actual contribution is 39% up to $50. And so there's some, when you start cranking on the numbers, you actually see an unexpected gain to the Fisherman's Fund with some of these 5 or 6 repeat customers. So their contributions are a portion, or the foregone revenue to the Fisherman's Fund is a portion of that $61,000, for instance, in 2012. But when you're looking at $2.7 million of revenue derived from crew license sales annually, we're talking $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, it's in the single percent as a share of that. So,
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question. I saw this this particular issue, I think, last year in resources. But is there a resident crew member commercial crew license?
There is.
What does it cost?
A resident crew license is $60.
Okay.
And so we've seen we had 20 residents buy a 7-day, and 2 that bought two of these 7 days. So by the time you get to 2, you might as well get an annual up for a resident. So it's far less of an issue on the resident side than the non-resident side.
And follow up, Representative Feige.
Now, for a lot of these, a lot of the fisheries in the state, some of them don't necessarily go on all year long. And some, like Bristol Bay, is about three week season that you're actually out on the water. If we were to make the 200, basically not even offer a 7-day license, you basically had to have a license. It was good for that calendar year. And the non-resident fee is higher than the resident fee. Are we going to end up hiring more Alaskans to work on our fishing boats?
Through the chair, of Senate, I don't. There's a mixture every year of resident and non-resident For instance, in 2012, we had 10,777 resident crew licenses and 10,158, so about 50-50. I mean, would it shift over? Would we hire more residents? Certainly possible. We still could get a non-resident coming up willing to spend $200 instead of buying multiple $30 licenses. Again, the numbers here aren't that great, but we could see some shift over to resident crew licenses. But these numbers on both the resident and the non-residents have been trending upward on both. Both as far as number of licenses sold.
Follow-up, Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a point of information, who's responsible for paying for a license, and in practice, who ends up paying for the license, the crew member or the vessel that's hiring that crew member?
It's through the chair, Representative Feige. It's the responsibility of the individual. I mean, for those I've talked to, you have to show up on a boat with a license, whether it's set it up somewhere else, I wouldn't know. But to the best of my knowledge, it's the individual's responsibility to have a license as a crew member.
Does the industry have an issue with hiring people? I mean, if we make the non-resident fee too high, are we going to end up with a labor shortage on our boats, or is this an issue at all? Is the money an issue at all?
Through the chair, the Senate, I do not believe the cost of the license is a barrier to
money. Thank you. And just for a little background for members that weren't here at the time, I mean, it's been quite a while. When, I think it was 2004 or 5 or something, when we passed this. And the reason for it was there was an expectation that maybe if we offered an opportunity for people to come up and they just wanted to go out, it's called dude fishing, go out and just see what commercial fishing is. Well, you can't go out and you can't pick up a fish or do anything like that without a license on a boat. If you do anything, you're illegal if you're on boat because you're acting as part of the crew. So the idea was, could we create a new economic opportunity for fishermen to have, advertise in the lower 48, come up and commercial fish for 7 days and lower that barrier instead of a $200 license for basically a tourist. And the question is, I have never seen any application of this in that way. And I don't know, does Fish and Game know of any advertisements or any businesses that have established for bringing in tourists that are then recruited to go out on, you know, Alaska Gold Rush or, the Time Bandit to go out and actually commercial fish or something. I mean, I haven't seen it. I was just curious whether the department knows of any.
Mr. Chairman, we've not seen anything in a real systematic way. I think it was probably always intended to be somewhat of a niche market, if you will, but I haven't seen it, so I couldn't really tell.
And the question is whether that niche is valuable enough to be losing $60,000 a year from license sales. And that's our question. In a time of constraint, these are non-residents, and they're going to be on a vessel, they're going to buy a license, it's required by law. The question is, in short pulse fisheries, do we want to say that a non-resident can come up and pay less than a regular resident crew license, for a week, or the same for if they're on a 2 week pulse in Bristol Bay? And that's a policy question. And so, Representative Grace Thompson.
A comment and a question. The first is, I know of folks who've come up and worked on boats, not in sort of capacities of tourists, but as a family member that might want to go out with a relative who owns a troll or gillnet or whatever. So I think it is being taken advantage, maybe not for the purpose specifically envisioned, but for a purpose that's in the spirit of what was envisioned. Can't speak if that's across the board. My question is, right now it seems as though the sort of price point, if you wanted to game the system and just get a series of seven-day licenses, 6 weeks. And has the department considered adjusting the price of a non-resident seven-day permit upwards so that that sort of price point shifts to a shorter time window?
Through the chair, Irvson, of course, Tompkins, that's really, that gets straight to the point of the matter. I mean, you can see on that, on the 2012 residents, we have 20 people that bought two of these. And if you had it, say, at $100 as a price point, if you're going to go do it once, you'd spend $100, and if you're going to do it for anything else, you might as well get an annual license, and you probably see a different market reaction to that price point. Now, we haven't proposed the bill. As I said, this was pretty flat for 5 years. It's kind of spiked up in the last 2 years. And so we're watching it to see if it were to continue or that trend continues to go up, it would be more of a compelling argument. But as far as introducing a bill, we don't have one in this year, for instance.
Follow-up,
this is perhaps a statement of my lack of institutional knowledge. So the $30 price was specified in the original bill?
Correct.
Okay.
Through the chair.
Yes.
Any other questions? The reason we're having this overview is because, you know, we are looking at fiscal constraints. We are looking at items that, are they accomplishing their goal? Should we address them? One of the things that we also have to realize is that Fisherman's Fund, which gets very little from a seven-day license, if somebody is coming up and they're brand new and don't know much, they're probably the most likely to get hurt. So although Fisherman's Fund, and we can get CFEC, they're here available if we want to know about those transfers or anything, but it's actually the Department of Labor who does that, Workers' Comp Fund. But the question is, should we be doing a full workers' comp coverage for very little premium, less premium than we would charge normal non-residents? That risk to the fund. And it's not like the fund is going broke or anything like that, but the reason we're bringing it up is it's a policy question. Do we think that this has, the seven-day license, have actually accomplished its goal, or is it having unintended consequence? And every time we're looking at an annual $50,000, $60,000 exemption to revenue that we'd be taking in, we're talking about a street, a temporary worker on the street, or we're talking about having a sonar on one of these smaller streams or a weir or something like that. So the balance is what we're looking at, and is this something that we think that should be maintained, and the committee can look at that later. So Representative Feige.
Thank you, Chairman. Kind of a question for clarification. As family members have come up that you're aware of, are they getting paid, or is this just kind of coming up to help out the family fishing boat and they take their week vacation on an icy strait or whatever and they go back?
The latter.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, is it possible through regulation that we exempt people that are not getting paid from the requirement to have the commercial license?
Representative Feige, we also get into the thing of all of a sudden we are now changing the requirement whether or not people have to have commercial licenses. We have them out there without insurance. So all of a sudden there's a whole lot of gamuts in there, and I think that we should be willing to consider that. We can also consider that the seven-day license, you know, if we want to keep that in there, we just don't allow multiples or consecutive. So that we, you know, that would be a way to say, okay, if you're coming up and you're going out for a week or 3 days or something, you know, you could do this, but we're not going to allow what is essentially happening is non-residents are coming up and using this to avoid paying for a full non-resident license. And I think that, you know, since it's spiking up, what it is that more people are finding out they can pay less and have all the benefits. So I think that maybe as we talk around this some more, we can consider what kind of policy option we think is appropriate, and if we want to change, then we can look at that as a committee. So, Representative Johnson.
One question, was there a sunset on that bill, do you recall?
There was not. There was no sunset on the bill, and so we haven't had an analysis. That's why I requested that they brief us.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple comments. One, with regard to whether they're paid or not, that'd be a real difficult thing for us to determine if they're going to be, if they're being compensated. The second, on sequential, again, we sell licenses through 1,000 vendors statewide, and you could buy one at Fred Meyer's and buy one at Western Auto or down the street, and it'd be hard for us to tell if it was a multiple license in that regard as well. So there's some limitations, that practical limitations on the system as far as monitoring that. That might be easier handled with a price point adjustment if that was, you know, the desire of the committee or the legislature.
And there's also the thing that if somebody would be violating it and have a fisherman's fund claim, the insurance wouldn't be valid if they weren't legally having the license. So that might eliminate some of that that probability. And people do want to be covered with fishermen's fund insurance when they're out on vessels. So all of those things are good to consider. Anybody else have anything? I don't see any. I'm sure glad we were able to get over the topic, and thank you for the charts and the explanations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And with that, there is 11:15, and Fisheries Committee will be adjourned.